Yet another edition of the Fringe Radio Show for the 23rd of November. I'd like to say happy Friday night, or I should say good early Saturday morning, depending where you're at in the country listening. The Fringe Radio Show is on Monday through Friday from midnight till 2 a.m. Saturday nights, we're here from 6 till 9. Our sponsor, Utah Go Green Carpet Cleaning. Utah Go Green are experts in the host dry cleaning system. They do encapsulation cleaning, bonnet shampooing, tile and grout. They specialize in slate floor cleaning and sealing. And they also do upholstery. With the holiday season coming on really quick, Thanksgiving is less than a week away. It's a good time to get your home in order. Give them a call at 801-808-3228. That's 801-808-3228, or visit them on the web at utahgogreencarpetcleaning.com. Of course, we're always live on the Inception Radio Network. We want to say good evening to all of our listeners who listen to us through Inception Radio. You can go to inceptionradionetwork.com and join the chat if you'd like. The Fringe Radio Show covers anything related to ghosts, paranormal, conspiracies, UFOs, alien abduction, science and science fiction, cryptozoology, afterlife, near-death experiences, historical events and conspiracies, plus so much more. Anything shrouded in just a little bit of mystery. As always, we ask our callers to be respectful of our guests and their beliefs as they're giving up their evening, or in this case, their morning, to be here with us. You can find Fringe Radio on the World Wide Web at www.thefringeradioshow.com. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. If you have a story, an experience, a sighting, or if you've just got questions for our guests and you don't feel like calling in, go ahead and email them in as we watch the email throughout the evening. The Fringe Radio Show, the call-in number is 801-254-5855. That's 801-254-KTKK. Or the Inception Radio Network provides a call-in number for questions at 1-888-919-2355. That's 1-888-919-2355. Last night, our guest, we had a great guest on, was Chris Benson. He is the author of three vampire books. We talked about old movies, Godzilla. And we're going to get him back on again, as he had a lot to do with Roswell and had deep interest in the Roswell investigation, a man of many talents. It was an honor to have Chris here last night. Our guest tonight, I am so honored to have and excited to have on the show, is Michelle Deschamps. Michelle is a former MUFON member and former provincial section director for Sudbury, Ontario, Canada. Since 1974, he's had 27 separate UFO sightings. He's appeared on numerous radio and television programs, including Midday Q, In the North, MCTV, Volt, and the Camilla Scott Show, just to name a few of them. He's contributed value information to the American researcher Jan Aldrich's project in Project 1947, which earned him an acknowledgement of his work in Jan's book, Project 1947, a preliminary report on the 1947 UFO sighting wave. He continues to inform the public about UFOs and flying saucers by lecturing on the subject. His expertise lies in researching Northern Ontario newspaper archives for UFO reports and UFO-related information. His website is Newfors, N-O-U-F-O-R-S, or No UFOs. Well, we'll have him pronounce it for us. Without any further delay, let's go ahead and get Michelle on the phone. Michelle, good evening. Welcome to K-Talk and the Fringe Radio Show.
Hi, Pat.
How are you this evening?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Well, we are honored to have you on the show tonight. I gave a little bit of your bio. If you wouldn't mind giving the listeners kind of a backstory, how did maybe talk about your sightings and how you got into being involved in this website that you have, which is just full of informational, excellent information and so much stuff, even above and beyond UFOs. How did it all start for you?
You know, I had a sighting when I was 9, and people have been asking me the same question, how did I get into this? And I'm not sure if it was my first sighting that actually propelled me, or if it was the interest itself, or maybe a composition of both. I think that over time I came to realize that this is probably my destiny, because I grew up in northern Quebec, and we moved in Ontario when I was 4.5 years old. My dad came to look for work, and he wound up working in a mine. And of course, Sudbury is, I think, in some respects, still considered the nickel capital of the world. We produce so much nickel. We have both, they've changed names, but we have Inco and Falconbridge based here. And so, it would explain a lot of sightings, because the first thing UFOs would investigate would be, you know, how far advanced is a civilization and what kind of mineral refinery techniques we have or whatever. So of all places my dad could have moved, the whole family was right where I've decided to stay. They've since sold the house and they've moved away back to the province of Quebec, but I stayed behind mainly because of my interest. And so, there was a sighting that I did have when I was 9, but also at the time a TV show called Project UFO was on the air. Mm-hmm. And I heard the term flying saucer for the first time back in 1964. Wow. And decided that of all topics I could have chosen to look into as deeply as I could, UFOs came to be the topic.
Interesting. And obviously you've had a lot of sightings through your lifetime. Is the UFO activity in Canada, I mean, is it a hot spot up there as well as it is here in so many, I mean, is there a lot of activity going on up there?
Yeah, well, I think we're still the only country in the world that actually keeps tabs on sightings and actually puts out an annual survey that comes out of the University of Manitoba by a guy by the name of Chris Rutkowski.
Right, we've had Chris on the show before, too. So much going on up there. I want to commend you on your website on the Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study Group. I actually spent tons of time looking through this, and the amount of information that you offer for people, it is an education to just delve through it.
Yeah, well, it started off as an idea for a book, and basically it was originally based on the news clipping archive search that I did for 5 Northern Ontario newspapers. They were all on microfilm at Laurentian University, which oddly enough is the place where Dr. Michael Persinger is based at, him and his magic lab there, and the magic helmet, as we call it. Mm-hmm. You might have heard about that.
A little bit. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, he contends to say that is one theory fits all. Whether you've had a sighting or apparition of the Virgin Mary, a UFO sighting, ghost sighting, or alien abduction, you can pretty well simulate all that using this special geared helmet inside this room where all your sensor, you're totally deprived of your sensory perception. And so a lot of scientists, I don't think, agree with him. But he's been written up in so many magazines that some skeptics and debunkers still tend to lean towards what he's saying is the explanation for all this stuff that's happening that's considered by us to be paranormal.
Gotcha. So we're imagining some of these things.
Apparently, you know, if it was a fact that we're surrounded by power lines that are emitting electromagnetic fields, I mean, I think we'd be seeing stuff all the time, nonstop.
Right.
And I don't think we're that nuts.
Exactly. I agree with you.
Yeah.
With, you know, just going through some of your talking points, and I'd love to cover a lot of different things with you.
Sure.
With all, you know, with UFOs, everybody, I think, is taken a different look at things lately. I mean, years ago, to talk about this subject, especially when you started seeing, you know, when you started seeing things in 74, in my lifetime, I've actually seen two that I know, like I've said so many times, if they are of this world, we have got some unbelievable technology, and if they're not of this world, we need to get that technology. But years ago, you just didn't talk about stuff like that. And these subjects were almost a little bit taboo. I mean, people that talked about it or had interest in it, you know, it was kind of, yeah, that's the crazy guy down there, a girl that talks about flying saucers. But it's really, really changed my view, as you mentioned with yours, and religious beliefs and things that we've believed in for such a long time. I think people maybe are not it's not that they're walking away from their faith or their religion, but I talk to so many people and interview so many researchers, and the trending seems to be that people are at least questioning things nowadays. They're not just taking that passed down, the passed down beliefs or the passed down traditions, when they see different things or, you know, look at the Bible, and a lot of researchers and authors have added a lot of, technical, translation into some of these things. People are starting to question things a little bit and question why and also question that things could maybe be a little bit different than they appear.
Yeah, I agree. It was one of the, later, as I see, not knowing how to lay out the book, when I had a book idea for all this stuff, and like I originally said, this was originally just based on those news clippings from those five Northern Ontario towns, but then it started expanding because I was getting UFO reports from teachers, fellow students, and when I got a hold of the microfilm reels from our own national archives, I bought five reels that contained thousands of documents. It dawned on me that maybe it's just more, it goes beyond just collecting news clippings, and I thought, well, with my frustration of how a lot of documentaries don't seem to talk about the physical evidence that's found at landing sites, some evidence, very little though, but some evidence found also during abduction cases and things like that, I thought it was important that the stuff is brought out more, because the documentaries, although they've gotten really good over the last few years, are finally focusing on physical evidence to show the skeptics, hey, there's something weird here that's going on that's not man-made, because man has tried to reproduce some of the effects, and they've been unable to. And I work with a bunch of skeptics who say, oh, yeah, the aliens are out there, but I don't think they've made their way here. I said, well, this is exactly why I've collected... I went beyond the call, the call of duty, and just gathered as many books as I could. And I have, like the military in the States, for instance, they say they've cataloged 57 species. I've cataloged about 86, and that's not even the ones performing the abductions per se, the repeat offenders, as I call them. They're on a separate page. I have an uncle who passed away who actually had seen two small beings. I know somebody personally in town here who had worked at one of the mining companies, and he had seen beings on two separate occasions. So they have made their way here, and maybe they were here a long time ago, but I think that the moment we detonated the first atomic bomb, it sent out a beacon signal for more of them to say, hey, the kids have found the matches, let's go check out, see what they're doing.
Right, exactly. With trace evidence, have you yourself collected any trace evidence? Have you actually gone or had the opportunity to go take a look at physical sites and looked at any physical evidence, or is it more of it people that send in photographs to you?
No, actually, I was lucky enough to actually go to a landing site that took place on Manitoulin Island. Manitoulin Island is located in the Great Lakes area near Georgian Bay, and it's about 2.5 hours from here. And I never took samples, to my chagrin. I mean, I just totally, I botched it all. That's why I say I botched my first and only case of a landing. But the thing that I found odd, the photos are on my website, and I will have to send you direct links later on so you can check them out for yourself. So you don't have to look through several pages to find it. But what I found odd was that the gravel and the sand was almost solidified, like it was stuck to the limestone surface. The area was about 80 to 90 feet across, and there was two donut-shaped, not really indentations. It was just the limestone was covered with a three-quarter-inch layer of gravel, and the gravel was blown away at two areas that made it look like there was two donut-shaped objects that had landed there. And I had spoken to Ted Phillips out of Missouri, who had investigated over 500 such landing cases, and has collected as many as over 3,000 landing cases from 95 countries. And he says, basically, he has a pretty good idea how big the objects were that could have caused that kind of landing trace, because it's consistent over time. And it was just to be on the actual site where something had happened that was highly unusual. It just gives you the heebie-jeebies, the hairs of the back of your neck to stand right up. And you know that something has happened there. It wasn't somebody on a trike or a three-wheeler doing donuts. There wasn't somebody on a snow machine, because these circles actually had survived a couple of winters. They were found in mid-September 1990, and I didn't get to go there until June of 91, and they were still present. And they were still present again till September of 1993. And by then, whatever was holding, I couldn't see any residue or any glue or anything holding the sand and the gravel together, but you could easily take a broom and sweep away all the limestone right off the gravel right off the limestone. Nothing was sticking to it, and after that trip, it was never there again. But it's very similar to some of the cases that Phillips investigated, very similar to the Delphos, Kansas case of 1971. Because it's a donut-shaped sort of marking, where the normal, in this particular case, it was pretty hard to tell if there was grass, because it was all limestone with a cover of a layer of gravel. But in some cases where it's grass, there's grass in the middle and grass on the outer perimeter, but the donut shape is totally devoid of vegetation due to radiation or whatever. And that's where it struck me to find the similarities. And then, as I was collecting, I no longer do, but I used to collect news clipping service by Lucius Farish out of Arkansas. And one case out of Denver, North Carolina was exactly similar to what I had investigated 11 years prior.
Interesting.
So it's like, wow.
Yeah. With these landing sites, like you said, the burn evidence or there's some markings there. Does the foliage or grass, Michelle, does it start to grow again, or does it pretty well? Do you think it gets irradiated and it's just dead earth, or have you seen actually or heard or had people report where actually the grass will start to or the foliage will start to grow again, or does it kind of kill whatever it sets down on?
In some cases, actually, nothing will grow back. Sometimes for 15 years or more, and sometimes the grass will grow back, but it'll be more lush than what was there before, or slightly discolored or whatever. It's really odd. And don't forget, also another important thing is, in 23% of the cases, based on what Ted Phillips has investigated, small footprints were found also at the sites.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to take a look at... on your site, do you have some of the Ted Phillips interviews or some of the information?
I have a link. I have a link to his website.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, for people who want to take a look at your site, and again, I commend you on the work here. I mean, this is almost like it's like a research guide on this. It's noufors.com. Go take a look at it. There's so much. The Northern Ontario UFO Research and Study website. There is, you could, I spent a ton of time, and obviously I even missed a lot of stuff. It's a guidebook for ufology. You could take that, Michelle, and print a book out of it, and there you go.
Yeah, exactly. It's been said to me, it says you should write a book or a companion booklet or something like that. So I might just do that.
Very interesting. As far as occupants, and you've got a title there, a little thing called Alien Abduction Entities. A lot of this stuff, is this pulled together from actual abductees or researchers? I didn't realize there were this many different drawings and tracings in here.
Well, I actually collected those from Linda Howe's books, and unbeknownst to her, actually, I would also promote her books by actually have a link directly to her website where people could purchase her books. But I feel it's important to share the information without necessarily charging any money. And also, because it was never my intent to make money off of this, I'm not even making money off the website. I mean, some people are urging me to, but to do that, but, excuse me, it's just that, I found it important for people to know that all these beings, different types of beings, had been seen at one time or another throughout the whole world, and it wasn't just an American thing or a Canadian thing. When I gathered all these books, and I noticed that there was a lot of references to, for instance, 1973, which was considered the year of the humanoid, because there was so many humanoid sightings all over, and that exactly is when the only photograph of a humanoid actually stems from, it was taken in Falkville, Alabama, by a police officer in 1973. And sure, people will say, oh, it looks fake. It looks like one of those firefighter wearing an aluminum suit or something, a foil suit. But it was a cop took the pictures. You know, why would he risk his reputation as a cop to falsify a photo?
Right.
You know, taken at 10 feet, 20 feet, 50 feet. And at the time, back in maybe 20 years ago, the very person, I forgot his name completely, but the very person who looked into the case actually sent me a collection, a snapshot of the several film strips with the actual photos on it. And so I have that next to the photograph, like an enlargement of the photograph of that being on that page that depicts the close encounters of the third kind, just the sighting of the beings. There's no direct interaction, not always.
Kind of a creepy looking character too, there, Michelle.
It's yeah.
Kind of hard to tell what it is, but you can tell the arms are quite a bit. They appear to be like claws almost on the end. It could be somebody wrapped in aluminum foil, of course, but unique looking.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but it'd be just like saying, well, okay, for instance, like in the case of Bigfoot, you could have a guy stand out in the woods wearing a suit in some isolated place. And what are the odds that a vehicle will happen to drop by and see the thing to report him as Bigfoot?
Right.
You know, some faker or hoaxer. Like the physical trace that I investigated, somebody said, well, it's probably fake. Well, it could have been faked. The only thing that I found odd was that it was a quarter mile into the woods, and like I said, the clearing was about 80 feet across, and it was completely surrounded by trees, so you couldn't even see it from the main road. If the hoaxer had planned this out, he would have placed it right next to the road where there's a high traffic area. You just don't do that. You know, UFOs are a lot smarter. Not always. It seems to be showing up more and more when people are seeing them instead of being more secretive, like you'd think they would be, but a lot of times these landing cases, they're purely accidental when you come across them. The people who were there, they would just happen to check their property like once a week, and they had no idea, and this thing appeared overnight.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. Do you get a lot of people that send you photographs and photos? Do a lot of people send things in to you for you to review?
Not photographs per se, but I do get a lot of reports. There's some years that it just dies right down, and some years we get a lot of reports. And now that I have a website, instead of just keeping it on paper, I actually post them with their permission. A lot of times they don't want to use their names and you know, just rather use their initials, sometimes not even that.
Sure.
And that's what I find so funny, because in the news clippings from the 50s and 60s and 40s, people had no qualms about mentioning their names and addresses and where they lived. Today it seems to be more, secretive. They're just not willing to either come forward or whatever. They're not looking for their 50 minutes of fame, I mean, like the skeptics would like people to think. I was reluctant to, when I had a sighting, at age nine, but then I didn't have a sighting until almost 20 years later. And I had the sighting at what we had was a radar base that was made famous in 1975 because it was the only Canadian installation along with four U.S. installations that were intruded upon by UFOs incessantly for almost a couple of months. And yet, we were covered by the jets from Michigan. We have a base in North Bay, which is only 2 hours east of here. But we were a different squadron. And somehow the F-106 Delta Dart from Michigan would be the one screaming in to chase away or try to photograph or intercept the UFOs that were over Sudbury at that time. And the Falconbridge radar base was made famous at that time. Well, I had my sighting there in 1990 when I was old enough to, and it's right by the airport too, so I knew what airplanes looked like at night. So I familiarized myself really, really quickly and became a very good observer very quickly. I only made one mistake, and one time I saw this cluster of three lights coming my way. Couldn't hear a sound. One big light in the middle, flanked by two smaller lights. Well, as soon as the object passed over my head, I then heard the sound. It was a plane, and I was almost waving it down with a flashlight, and I said, that was my first mistake I ever made, and my last. And I said, you can't just judge or assume you're seeing a UFO within seconds. Sometimes you may have to stand outside for an hour looking at the object to see if it's going to behave in a very odd way, or if you'll hear the sound, if it's a plane, or if you'll see the maneuvers, or not, depending what it is. And so all these ideas came. This is what needs to be done with the website, because I couldn't see it anywhere else online. You didn't have a page that would describe all the eight or nine criteria as to what to look for in a UFO sighting, and then all the things that were ever used as an excuse to explain away UFO sightings. I've done that. And so hopefully it's people who say, well, okay, how can I cross-reference something I've just seen with something that could be man-made, could be military, because that's the biggest excuse now. Oh, it's got to be military. Well, I still have doubts that the military can build triangular objects that are 2 miles wide, completely silent, can hover 500 feet above ground, just above the ground, which is, in most cases, it's illegal to fly within 500 feet of the ground, whether it's over a mining site or an airport or whatever, or military base. And you know, so you have to keep common sense in there somehow. And for some stupid reason, and people have totally thrown common sense out, and right away they assume it's either military, it can't be something from someplace else, and maybe it will be really hard at some point to distinguish between what's man-made and what's not, even though the two objects that you're looking at are beyond the range of technology as we know it. You know, that's where the damn shame lies. And it's like, okay, somebody's going to have to come out and say, well, this is ours and this is not. But, you know, the way I see it now, it's like history is a complete lie and it's been superimposed by something else. And all this UFO stuff is made to be the subject of ridicule.
Exactly, exactly. Well, we, We have had a rash of, I get a lot of listeners that send in, not so much photos. I've gotten a few photos, but most of them send in the same thing, the stories and sightings. One thing that we're tending to get a lot of here that seems to be quite prevalent in the California area are these what people are describing as translucent triangles that are flying at a very low altitude. Matter of fact, I had a pilot send me some emails here a few months ago in the Huntington Beach area, and he said he would see these things fly overhead, you know, probably around between 1,000 and 1,500 feet, very low altitude, what he would call vertical afterburners, one on each point of the triangle. They'd fly out over the ocean, and then within a matter of minutes, F-16, F-15 type fighters following them, but white ones with absolutely no markings on them whatsoever. There's been a rash of those seen on the West Coast as of late.
Wow.
And, people are reporting them like crazy. They're seeing them like crazy. But yet you do have a lot of the debunkers that are just saying, well, it's a new, you know, it's military aircraft, what have you. But translucent triangles, I think, are pretty unique.
Yeah, that's a new one.
Yeah.
You know, they seem to just like we're building new models of cars and vans and SUVs every year, they seem to be keeping up with their own upgrades.
Exactly.
You know? The thing is, I don't know how many cases have actually recorded the speed at which these things leave. My friend from Inco, he had a sighting in 1967 where it flew over the Inco plant, causing a 15-minute power blackout. And of course, back then they had to report to New York City about the power loss because it was also a big loss in production. And as the UFO departed, the power came back on, and he by then had already made a few calls to the radar base, which is no longer existent, and they were open with them. They told them and said, yeah, we tracked it before it went below the radar line, and then we picked it up again when it left. And when it left, it took off at 22,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
And it's 1967. Now, my friends are like to argue that since 1947, since the famous Roswell crash, we've had enough money, enough years to back engineer something like this. Well, I'm telling them this would be like giving Christopher Columbus a nuclear sub and asking him to duplicate it.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
I don't care how much money is dumped into it. I suspect the military, they may have discovered some things, maybe bench lab experiments, maybe more. I don't know. I'd love to be proven wrong. But I think they're more frustrated than anything else because the aliens aren't giving them everything. And they wouldn't be stupid. That would be like us giving a loaded gun to a monkey.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, so you don't do that. No matter how advanced or how non-advanced you are, well, maybe we'd do that because we're clumsy humans at times, but or with very little common sense. But it's just, I don't know, I could be wrong, and I'll be the first one to admit it if I'm wrong and say, okay, some of these things are military, but I would need just as much proof for that as proving that there's been something that's been hoaxed.
Right, exactly.
You know, you have to have it both ways. You can't just demand, oh, I want evidence that this was real, so if not, well, then it's got to be a hoax. Well, the same thing has to be, you know, of course, my own eyes don't lie to me. I've never changed my story. I've talked to a lot of people who their own only one-time sighting has completely changed them for life. And I kind of gave him a little warning and said, well, now that you've seen something totally out of the ordinary, don't be surprised if you see something else because you'll know exactly what to look for in a UFO sighting, or at least you'll know how to distinguish that from something that's normal.
Right. And I think that's, you know, that's the biggest thing, Michelle, is educating people. I know around here, I don't know up in your neck of the woods, but it seems like there was, these Chinese lanterns. Those are, there's tons of those. Not so much this year. I know a lot of states are outlawing them because when they end up landing somewhere, now you've got an open flame with essentially a tissue paper wrapper around it that could easily catch fire. But In years past, especially around the holidays, people were reporting them as orbs and stuff, and there was tons of them flying. A couple of times they caught me off guard here, actually. In my neighborhood, there was some flying around the holidays. But like you said, it's to learn to try to decipher what's real and what's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, I've had people here report the same thing, and thankfully I know some people who actually took photographs of the Chinese lanterns, and I've wanted to launch a few just to film them, but somebody's already done that on YouTube apparently, and I've got a nice still photograph that I've placed, and I've added that to the list. You know, people would claim that Northern Lights can be made to look like UFOs. I said, no way. UFOs have a distinct shape. Northern Lights are the way they are. And I've placed three different kind of photographs of Northern Lights to show if and when I could find photographs for some of the things that have been used as an explanation to quickly explain away sightings, I would use the photograph in that page. I'll send you the link when I can. But it's a page that I thought it was important to be done.
Sure.
Because I've got a picture also of the Batman emblem, which was made famous in the States, in Alabama, during some high intense activity of mutilations. And the Batman emblem is an artifact that you get when you're trying to zoom in too closely to an object, a source of light, using a camcorder. And people don't know that no matter how much you try to zoom in, you're not going to have a crisp image of the object. It's going to be distorted. And so it becomes like a Batman emblem, like a circle with a bite at the top, or sometimes two bites at the top and one bite at the bottom. And I found a picture of that so that I could show people, this is, don't take that as what the actual UFO looks like. You know, you may not be able to get a good visual on something that's putting out more light than daylight.
Correct.
You know, you can't see the shape, outline, whatever, because of the configuration of light is so intense in the foreground of whatever's putting out these lights. So,
and even working with people, I mean, everybody now with the advent of the smartphones and, you know, these iPhones and the digital phones that have such great cameras in them, but it seems like when people see something unique, the problem they all have, and I think it's just pure excitement, is they put it on the highest zoom level, and that just gives you the big blotch, which you can't tell anything there.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
Trying to photograph them properly is very interesting. Speaking of photographing UFOs, have you ever looked at any of the work of Wilbur Allen by any chance?
No.
Wilbur Allen is he works for National Geographic magazine. We've had him on the show. And he was a photographer for the White House. He claims to be an abductee from a young age. He was a photographer for the White House for several years, and then he became the Air Force One technical correspondent for ABC News. And Wilbur, very interesting, people that want to, you know, talk about photography of unidentified flying objects. He has, of course, a lot of cameras because of his line of work, but it's amazing when he takes these Nikon, these high-end Nikon cameras, and sets these up at night, and will sometimes shoot literally between 70 and 100,000 photos. It's amazing what these cameras will capture. The amount of activity that the human eye can't even see, stuff that jets across the horizon, jets across over our homes in a matter of milliseconds. And if you want to look at something really interesting, Michelle, take a look at Wilbur Allen's website. Just if you put Wilbur Allen UFO, he keeps his site like yours very updated. He updates his once a day and has all these photographs on it, taken at high speed and long, long intervals. It's amazing what you can catch if you just let a camera roll or even a video camera and then break things out frame by frame.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm not surprised that he's capturing so many, because that's the thing, the conclusion I've come to is that they're there. I haven't even skywatched in the last 5 years because I know they're there. All we need now is the skeptics to have their own sighting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm leaving it up to them to have their own sighting. I've had 27 sightings. They all look different. Some look more mundane than some other ones. You know, some were less exciting. But, or sometimes it was the back end of somebody else sighting that would call me on the phone and say, if you go outside, you get dressed, go outside, you'll see them. And this one particular night, I went outside and I drove up to a vantage point, and it was totally silent. And if I hadn't turned around with even with my camcorder aimed in the direction, and back then my camcorder was the one that held a full-size VHS tape, I never caught anything on tape. But with my naked eye, I saw these two source of lights that were flickering so fast, and the only way I could sketch them, they looked like sea urchins. And they were at the speed of jets, but they were below 500 feet, and they may be less than a quarter mile away from me. And it's like, wow, if I hadn't gone outside after he gave me a phone call, and this is an auto mechanic who was a pure skeptic before he even had his first sighting, which shook him up pretty bad.
With all and, this, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I tend to ramble on because a passion.
That's what this is all about. I don't like to have scripted shows. I like to let the guests talk. I don't like to interfere. With your sightings, Michelle, did you have anything very, let's call it up close and personal, some really, really, with the 27 you saw, was there some really close stuff that, there was no ifs, ands, or buts, it was not of this world?
I'd say the one at the radar base, although it wasn't, the closest that it might have been probably was 6 miles. When I first saw it, and this is so odd because it was the summer of 1990, in the fall of 1990 I had the sighting, but in the summer of 1990, I was working at a dealership, and that's when I met, quote-unquote, UFO Don. That's what its license plate said. A salesman came in and said, hey, check out this guy's license plate, and that's where I got the idea for mine. And we talked, and I was on a 15-minute break, but we wound up talking for half an hour. I almost got in trouble. We exchanged notes. I took his address down. And this particular night in October, I was at the dealership because I had access to the photocopying machine, and I was, oddly enough, photocopying three 1967 UFO or Flying Saucer magazines, which later he gave me the copies. And as I walked to my car outside, I saw this object in the sky that looked as bright as Jupiter at its brightest. But the odd thing was, as it was coming down from the sky, and it was a noticeable movement, it was getting brighter. So I said, oh, this thing is coming down at 45-degree angle. And I was looking towards the city of Sudbury. I lived 20 miles north at that time. And I proceeded to go down the hill after I told the salesman, I'm going to check this out, because he just shrugged his shoulder, didn't believe me or whatever. And later on, I did stop at two other locations to see the object, but I was looking at it through trees, of course, devoid of leaves because it's October. And I said, I got to go to some other vantage point. And so I went to my favorite hilltop, and from there, the Falconbridge radar base at that time was exactly 4.5 miles away. And by then, the object was no longer looking like a little white egg, where the brilliance of it had dissipated by then. But it was a red pinkish object, almost pulsating irregularly. And it was, my estimation at the distance was maybe 60 to 70 feet off the ground, exactly where the radar base is located. Although I couldn't see the radar base at night. We're talking between 8:30 and 9 o'clock at night in October, because of the street lights along the highway, I knew exactly where this thing was. And my assumption is, this was 1990, my assumption is that the UFOs, having maybe perhaps been tracked on radar before, were investigating as to why was it that the base was no longer functioning. The base had been closed between 1986 and 1987.
Interesting.
And so I'm assuming that the UFO was there to check it out, see how come there was no longer operating. Because I have documents from the National Archives about how they were tracked on radar. I even had one of the radar technicians contact me out of the blue years later and told me that what they tracked was a solid return, and it was not these four smaller objects that were being seen in town by our nursing staff and the police officers, which were the first witnesses, but it was the quote-unquote aircraft carrier that was parked over a neighboring town 30 nautical miles from the radar base. And he says, we checked the radar, and this object was huge, bigger than our biggest plane that we had in our inventory at that time. between 42 to 72,000 feet in altitude for almost over 2 hours. Hmm. Yeah. So the radar-based incident, my incident in 1990 was the one that convinced me, but it took me 3 days to gather up the nerves to call the police department because at that time I hadn't joined MUFON yet. And I didn't know where else to report the sighting, and I think they kept me on the line long enough to determine whether or not I was nuts.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We actually had a couple questions for you, Michelle. One listener sent a question, said, is the Canadian government more open to UFOs than the United States government, in your opinion?
Yes, it is. Up to a certain point, Chris Rutkowski, of course, from Manitoba, has been named the receivership. He supposedly is the one now to receive any incoming UFO reports that the Canadian government receives. But I still think that he's not quite getting all the juicy reports. Like, let's say we had crash retrieval cases or radar trackings, like solid radar trackings. I don't think he's getting all the juicy cases if they were to happen to this day. Maybe the older reports, he's got the same microfilm reels or documents that I have where the names are not blacked out, the names of the witnesses or whatever. And later on, they went back and they apparently blacked out the names, or it's even harder for any civilian now to even purchase these microfilm reels, but I have five of them. And it's open. The Canadian government is pretty open with the UFO reports, but I think there's a good possibility that they're also listening to us researchers because we're the ones who are getting possibly more calls about it. Nobody's calling the government anymore. Nobody trusts the government anymore to tell them the truth. You know, it's being relied upon, the civilians, and the researchers to tell the truth,
exactly,
and to report accurately what's going on. But like I said, there may be 90% of the reports that are not, they're going unreported. So you can just imagine that maybe 10% of that we actually get.
Exactly. Interesting.
You know,
the thing here, Michelle, is that it seems like the media, at least in the United States, and I'm sure you can watch it as well as we can, you're close enough, at least the media, and not in the United States, but around the world, I'm starting to notice, it's backed off a little bit. For a while, though, even mainstream media was putting a lot of these, the live video stuff up, unless it was some sort of a hoax, and of course there's plenty of people on YouTube that want to create the hoax videos, which definitely discredits the researchers' work. Like the UFO that was over the Beijing airport. This thing was the size of a city. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, again, with all these cameras, it's hard to dispute it. And it seemed like for a while it's backed off. But the media, the mainstream media, the local TV channels, starting to put, you know, things that they captured on film, on television and out there for the public to see, and not making fun of them, you know. But but as of late, it seems like it's quieted down quite a bit. And as far as government, and we could talk in the next hour, we could talk about disclosure. The government, at least here in this country, still seems to take the stance of, you know, they just don't want to comment on it. And of course, a lot of the media outlets, while they were showing these things, then, you know, you'd hear the laughing and snickering. Is it this? Is it that? It's kind of sad. It can work to the positive, and yet it can work in the negative too.
Yeah, and I just don't get that. It's like I don't even know what it's going to take for the American government to come up and fess up to this stuff, because the Brazilian government have released documents. The French government has released documents. Belgium has had those report. The Cometa report came out. Like I said before, Canada puts out an annual survey on the sightings, and sometimes it's a race between British Columbia and Ontario as to who got the most reports. You know, but it's just, are all the other countries trying to put the states to shame by maybe forcing their hand? But you know what? I don't think the truth is going to come out of them on their own. I think it's either the alien presence is going to increase, which is going to force their hand to say, okay, We admit it. You know, they've been around for a long time, and we can't do a darn thing about it.
Right.
It's going to happen, because I don't know when. I don't know if disclosure is around the corner, but the thing is, this truth is so big that I just don't understand the common sense of them, whoever they are, that they can keep the lid on this secrecy forever. It's a pot that's boiling over,
yeah,
to say the least. And with more races possibly making it here for the first time, it's going to make it more difficult for them to keep it secret or to cover. They can't be everywhere at once, you know? And like I said, I've cataloged 85, 86 different species, and that's not even counting the ones that are repeat offenders, the ones that are always coming over and over again, the grays, the tall whites, the praying mantis types, you know, the ones that are performing the abductions. So who's to say what's going to happen around the next corner?
What's your take on abductions? What are your thoughts on that? I've had the opportunity to opportunity to talk with a lot of abductees. I'm not a skeptic by any means, but I am skeptical. The way I feel about it, and I'm sure you do too, you want to know the truth. I mean, I believe there's a lot of people that claim to be abducted, and sometimes I think it's wishful thinking. I've also done a lot of research on sleep paralysis, and that can also be very similar to, you know, what people call an abduction scenario. But then you do come across some of the people that, you know, you have to half believe, especially, I mean, there's quite a few of them that I've interviewed that I believe something has happened to them. Are there a lot of abductions in Canada? Is that frequent up there or commonplace? Or I shouldn't say commonplace, but are there a lot of those occurrences and people reporting that?
Well, I know of at least three, I think a few years back, some of my contacts, my fellow ex MUFON Ontario members in Toronto, and my web host, who's a former member as well, sent me information once. He sent me some information about there being like five reported cases of abduction in Toronto area itself, like metropolitan area. I know of at least three people that I've interviewed, and two of whom I'm friends with that actually are claimed to be abducted. And I think, in a way, it ties in with my, it sort of ties in with my religious beliefs, and also stuff that ties in with the TV show Ancient Aliens, which I think is dead on. I mean, I've been watching that even when In Search of was airing back in the 70s, and then Chariot of the Gods and stuff like that. And I think that, I don't know which species, anybody claiming that they know the answers to that, I think is full of BS. We won't know the answer unless somebody comes up and tells us. But I think that over a period of time, we've been tweaked by a particular race, which accelerated our development. And I think that these abduction cases is a way for them to sort of check our progress, maybe at the same time doing something to us that's bridging the gap between us and them for some reason. And that throws in an entire new ball of wax where they say, okay, well, people believe that we were born of God or whatever. Well, yeah, but, you know, it's a lot easier for me now to believe. I hate the word to believe, and so do my friends, because once you've seen UFOs, you're not a believer, you're a knower. You know they're real.
Right, right.
A belief is based on having faith on something you haven't seen, like the belief in God. Or whatever. Jesus, I believe, was one of theirs. I mean, Jesus could do things that no normal human could do. And the Star of Bethlehem, I believe, was a UFO, because it was seen twice during the same day, and it was moving as the three kings followed it until it made a stop over the manger. For some reason, it's depicted like that in every culture. And so it's made me realize that maybe there's a good possibility that something else is at play here. And then these abduction cases is a way for them to monitor us, to see what we're going to do next, what other stupid moves we're going to make next. And I think that there's possibility of a race out there. I've heard this from Major Robert Dean, who says that there is a race that they have no, they can't interfere, but one particular race will definitely step in if things get really bad. Whether we are at a point of annihilating ourselves or self-destructing ourselves or whatever. I mean, we're some kind of genetic bank for them, but if we're the product of some kind of experimentation or, not experimentation, but using a primitive proto-human and making it a more modern human and for whatever purpose.
Michelle, I got to stop you for a second. Okay. I've got an NBC news break coming up. Can we keep you for another go around?
Sure.
All right. I love talking about this stuff, and again, fascinating. Our guest tonight, Michelle Deschamps. His website is NOUFORS, an awesome site. We'll be back with him on the other side of the NBC News break. Get yourself a little something to drink. You're listening to The Fringe Radio Show on K-Talk, KTKK AM 630 in Salt Lake City. We're live on the Inception Radio Network. We'll be right back with Michelle. Stick around.